Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thanks to Kulufela for that news update. There'll be more news at 7 o'clock. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with Moneyweb. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at the results out of Astral Foods as well as We Buy Cars. Both companies provided us with full year's performance updates from their perspectives. And we're going to speak to the respective CEOs of these organizations and get a sense of how each company has fared. Then we have a conversation with Chief Economist at Rand Merchant Bank, Isaiah Mhlanga, on the government's announcement last week at the midterm budget policy statement that we would be looking at a 15 billion rand infrastructure bond to help finance some of our projects domestically. We're going to take a look at that, see if we can wrap our heads around it. We also have a conversation with the principal officer at Bonitas Medical Fund, Lee Kalakop, and getting a sense of how to navigate the decisions that members and consumers make when deciding on how to pick the right medical scheme. And then we're going to wrap up the show with a digital drive conversation. We're going to speak to a resident tech and EV specialist who's also the founder of Recharge.co.za, Nafisa Akabor, around how to stay safe when shopping for Black Friday this month.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick off the show with a sense of market movements and other decisions that affect markets. I'm joined on the line by founder at Just One Lap and good friend of ours, Simon Brown, to take a look at market movements and see what we make of them. Simon, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. I suppose a strong start to local equity markets, slightly weaker start from a Rand perspective, considering where we were on Friday. And I'm guessing locally markets might still be digesting that ratings upgrade that came through after market close.
Evening, Jimmy. Absolutely. And we must remember we had the medium-term budget policy statement from the finance minister on Wednesday. That was very well received from the market on the day. And then on Thursday, we had we were up at you know, over 2,000 points at one stage. And then Friday we sold off. And the ratings upgrade, as you said, after the close, the market was kind of punch drunk from good news, is my sense. So we opened nicely this morning. We actually drifted red, and then eventually we closed the day in the green. Not massively. Volumes were, frankly, a bit average. I think there's just been a lot of expectation around this coming. Big winners, of course, banks, low inflation targets, budget surpluses, upgrades in our credit rating. All good for the banks. None of our banks have been expensive for ages, and they really, really benefited. And the Rand, it strengthened at sort of midday. It got to around 17.06, trading around 17.13 at this point against the dollar. And it is, again, I think it was massive enthusiasm. And now eyes are looking to what's next on the horizon, local or international.
Speaking of what's next, Si, I know we've got that interest rate decision coming out this week from monetary policy. We also have one coming out of the United States, and looking at markets on Friday, there was a bit of trepidation in the market as participants kind of weighed up whether or not we would get a December cut. I know it's still too soon to look forward to December, but I want to get your thoughts around this week's rate cut. Do we see one on the cards for South Africa?
I think we do. And inflation 3.4, the minister confirmed an inflation target of 3% on Wednesday. Importantly, he said that with a 1% band either side. So technically, we've got a 2 to 4% inflation target, and we're anchoring on 3%. But that means that if we're at 3.4, and that's broadly what the Reserve Bank is expecting inflation to be next year, we're not worried about, we're not going to shoot over through 4. I think he can do a 0.25% cut. Will the MPC, Jimmy, you know as well as I do, as well as the listeners know, that MPC, they do not like handing out rate cuts. they are stingy with rate cuts. So, I would say there's a better than 50% chance. But there's always a chance not. I think we're in the right space. I think there's a window here of goodwill and visible improvements and tangible economic activity, which I think gives them that space to cut. And particularly if we're expecting more rand strength, we've seen strong bond buying by foreigners in our markets. That's helping the rand. I think we can do a rate cut. If I were on the MPC, I would vote cut.
Well, we should perhaps get you onto the MPC's committee, because I am sure we can all do with a rate cut at this point. So I want to take a look at the performance of the rand at the moment, holding its ground against the dollar. We know that some of the dollar factors keep sliding back and forth, but you're seeing some real improvement against the likes of the euro and the British pound. The rand very much looking to finish the year in strong territory, and it looks as though we've got enough to do that.
I think you're right, and I think you make a great point there, Jimmy. The rand dollar, we get that story. There's lots to it. Part of it is dollar weakness. Part of it is people buying our bonds. The precious metal prices helping, etc. But there is the I didn't expect to see the euro down at 19.85. That did surprise me. Pound 22.55. The pound's having a rough time. They've got the unfortunate position of their 30-year gilts, sort of the highest it's been in 20, I think, since 1998. And they've got an increasing budget deficit. So they're in a bit of a crunch. But some strength against the pound, I think we can see more of that. The euro, it's surprising me, but we'll absolutely take it. And it goes back to the earlier point. There's just a general positive sentiment. And I want to make two things clear. The one is it's not being felt on the ground because it's early days. It's not, people getting better jobs and more jobs and stuff. That is a process. And I think that's the second point, which is that this happens slowly. It happens, but it happens slowly. Turning around an economy is a huge task. And we're seeing green shoots.
So I want to leave the conversation by taking a look at some developments locally. We got trading statements out of Naspers and Prosus. We also got interim updates from the team at 91, which is probably one of the largest asset managers, barring the PIC, that we have in South Africa. I want to get your thoughts around anything that you're picking up there. Companies will obviously start to report and give us more frequent updates, but every now and then it's always nice to see if there's some surprising news. Anything stand out for you there?
I think 91, I really like the numbers. I thought that was a good set of results. We're not seeing all of the Sanlam deal with them. They're going to be managing Sanlam money. That's not all in that process yet. That'll still to be coming through. I was surprised by the market reaction, which put the stock down almost 2%. And in a day that we saw financials doing well, banks were certainly doing much better. But it is a stock that's run. It's pulled back a bit at the moment. It has run, and so I think we could perhaps expect some of that. The Astral was a great turnaround after a first half of negative operating margins in the boiler business. They got that turned, and I think that was a really good accomplishment. And I think they're looking good going forward if Yellow Maize stays down.
Companies are doing better than others, but each company having to contend with the different factors, as are markets in general, and that's probably why we're seeing some volatility at this time in the year. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much, as always, to founder of Adjust One Lap, Simon Brown, for joining us to take a look at market movements and share his thoughts around what markets could be weighing up.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We buy cars completed their second financial year as a listed entity, the full financial year that is, having listed around April of 2024. This time round, results show that revenues were up 13.1%, units sold increased by 8%, even a final cash dividend per share increasing by about 20%. For more on these, I'm joined on the line by the CEO at We Buy Cars, Faan van der Walt, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Faan, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. I know we caught up fairly recently when the trading statement was updated, and I was looking forward to this conversation, knowing that we'd have a bit more color around some of the details of that trading statement. Let's start with your reflections on the year that was. How was the year for you and the team?
Good evening. Thanks for having me, and good evening to all the listeners. Yes, We Buy Cars had a good year. We grew by 15%, which is probably not exactly where we would like it to be. But, you know, compared to other role players in the industry, I think we fared well having proper double-digit growth. The second half of the year slowed down a bit with the influx of a lot of cars that compete with our offering, especially in the higher price range segment, which did have an impact on inventory. You know, as we had a bit of a slowdown in the upper end, as especially these new Chinese entrants coming in the market between 400,000 and 500,000 rand, that makes a really compelling case, and that segment overlaps with our upper end in the used car price segment. So we had to adjust prices, take a bit of a margin squeeze there, and clear out inventory that wasn't moving because of that. We have now adjusted, and we're ready to move into a new year with a healthy stock balance and a proper mix regarding stock. So looking back, you know, we've seen these acceleration and deceleration periods when it comes to used car prices and the way they depreciate quite a few times historically, you know, and that's got a lot to do with new vehicle supply. Now, we all need new vehicle supply because today's new car is tomorrow's used car, and we love having more and more cars on the roads. It stimulates trade, it provides mobility, which is great for the economy.
Faan, the Chinese car markets, or at least the introduction of new Chinese vehicles, is certainly something interesting. I mean, I saw you flagged it in the SEN statement. You've also just reiterated now that it has got you rethinking some of the decisions you're making with some of the other segments that you look at. How are you seeing that market where it comes to the secondhand side of it? I mean, the new Chinese vehicles are one thing. The secondhand Chinese vehicles, do we have enough data from that perspective to look at it as a secondhand car market and say this is perhaps how we see it fitting in with the other offerings that are out there at the moment?
That's a great question, and you know, we've been monitoring this closely over the last few years as we see new players arrive into the market, and some players have been around for quite a while now. A typical example would be GWM Haval. They are no newcomers to the industry, so we have record of all those transactions that we've done with those vehicles, and we keep our finger on the pulse as what's happening in the market. So what we've noticed is that these vehicles would have a fairly similar depreciation curve to the legacy brands, and sometimes they hold their value even better because they play in a segment of the market where there is huge demand. So a good example would be Jetour that we have on the floor. What, that's 1 year old, with 25,000 kilometers, brand new. You could buy it for 480. We sell it for 420. So that's about let's call it a 20% depreciation in the first year, which is normal for a new vehicle. Sometimes a bit excessive, but for that price range vehicle, I would say that's fairly normal, and then it flattens out to around 1% per month going forward. The moment you drive off the floor, you typically lose 10% of the value. So that's more or less in line. And there's a great appetite in the second-hand market for these vehicles. They sell quick. People love buying them new, and they love buying them in the second-hand space. How they will fare in the long run, let's say in a decade's time, you know, there are question marks over the longevity of some of the brands, fuel economy, and whether they would be reliable in the long run. But so far, it looks promising. The only complaints we've had on quite a lot of the Chinese vehicles is that they are not as economical as people expected, because the engine technology might not be as competitive as some of their German counterparts. Mm-hmm. That has a more sophisticated engine technology. But that's also bound to change, you know, as new models come into the market.
Mm. Fine, let's take a look at the rest of the We Buy Cars business. Units bought increasing, units sold increasing, and I guess logic would tell you that you want to sell more than you are buying in terms of inventory. That's always a good thing to be able to reflect on. But I want to get your thoughts around how the business is positioning itself going into the new financial year. Obviously, some of the challenges around the Chinese businesses and the Chinese automotive competitors, nothing you can do about that. But from a business perspective, you're upgrading facilities, you're increasing parking bays, you're expanding into regions like Rustenburg and the Vaal Triangle. Take us through how the business is repositioning, particularly because I think as someone who is the co-founder of the business, you've got a very unique perspective on how you see this growing.
Yeah, growth is part of our DNA, and a question we quite often get is how big is the size of the prize, or how big is the pie, and how much more can you grow? So we need to determine how much we can still grow. And one way of doing that is looking at how many cars are there in South Africa and how often are they traded. Now, the eNATIS system gives us statistics on how many vehicles get traded in the used space per month, as well as how many vehicles are registered for the first time as new vehicles. Now, new vehicles sits at around 50 to 55,000 a month, and used vehicles are about three times more, sitting at about 160,000, which was last month's figure. So for every new vehicle sold, there's about three used vehicles being registered, and then we measure our number of vehicles that we've sold as a percentage of that, and that brings us to about between 10 and 12% usually. Now, if we go back in time to 2021, using the same metric, we were sitting on 5.2%. So we've more or less in 5 years' time doubled our market share. And as you can see, the market is quite big. So we will continue striving to double it again within the next 5 years. And beyond. So in order to do that, we need systems, we need technology, and we need facilities. This year, we were running low on space as well, because our inventories or our floor space was reaching capacity and even went over capacity. And then we opened a Vereeniging branch, which relieved some of that. And next week, we're opening a mega branch in Gauteng in Montana, Pretoria North. And following that, about a month later, we'll open in Cape Town, in Lansdowne. And both of these facilities will add probably another 3,000 bays to what we have, which is over a 20% growth in bays, which is exactly what we need to grow even further. And on these sides, we could even in future add more bays. But over and above that, we'd also be opening early in the new year in Emalahleni or the old Witbank, and there are a few other towns we're also looking at. So expansion is part of what we do. We've now gotten really good at it, and we deliver on time and within budget.
Still focused on growth and focused on delivering the best results to shareholders. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to the Chief Executive Officer at We Buy Cars, Faan van Walt, for joining us to take a look at the performance of the year that was.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Astral Foods Limited released their annual results for the year ended 30 September 2025. An increase in the cash dividend, increase in revenues, increase in profits. All in all, looks like a good set of numbers from the business. I'm joined on the line by the company's Chief Executive Officer, Gary Arnold, to take a look at the performance and see what we make of it. Gary, always lovely catching up with you. Always lovely having you on the show. Let's start with your initial thoughts and reflections around the year that was. It's seemingly a tale of two halves, much like Astral has become accustomed to. Nice rebound in the second half of the year, but take me through just your thoughts on how you saw it as a team.
Yeah, Jimmy, good evening, and to your listeners. Very much a tale of two halves. You know, certainly You might recall when we spoke at our interim results, May, entering May, our 6 months ending March this year was a tough period for us. Negative margins in the business on poultry. We had seen selling price deflation, which had filtered through into the business quite severely and putting a lot of pressure on operating margins. So, went into this half looking to recover selling prices. I mean, at least to cover input costs and the inflation around input costs that this business sees on an annual basis. And then I think a positive note was that the market was well balanced in supply and demand, and we could bring additional broiler volumes to the market, which we've been able to sell and sell them at a better price. And then we had softer input costs and feed prices. And if you recall, 70% of the life cost of rearing a broiler is feed. So, in a market that one sees lower maize prices, that does filter through. And that's where we saw the tailwinds and the margin improvement.
Now, Gary, this might very well be the final year of reporting under the AGOA agreement, the African Growth and Opportunities Act, that we've been benefiting from with the United States. I want to get your thoughts around that. It seemingly happens to coincide with your financial year end as to when the agreement was last in effect. So effectively, the next time you and I speak in this new current financial year, we could very well be speaking without any AGOA in place. Is that going to be a big difference for the business? Does that have you guys concerned?
Jimmy, we can talk about the impact of AGOA on the country and then our concern around obviously the impact, negative impact that it'll have for various businesses and jobs. I see that there was on Friday, concession signed by the US around our citrus exports, so at least they've got some interim reprieve and are able, to send the citrus out to the US tariff-free. So that's some good news. How it impacts the poultry industry is around the AGOA quota itself. So, on the back of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, we as an industry in 2015 negotiated annual quota, and it's now about 72,000 tons. It started at 65,000 tons, which was free of the anti-dumping duty that's levied by South Africa on poultry imports. Now, that quota, in terms of the agreement reached in 2015, should fall away. In other words, the US have applied 30% tariffs and then AGOA expired. So, by all intents and purposes, that AGOA quota should fall away. It hasn't been removed yet, even though, the Department of Trade and Industry and Competition is legally bound to remove it and make that recommendation to Treasury. They haven't yet. In our engagement with that department, I think they are still using this as a hope and the means to try and negotiate a better trade deal. But certainly, we're keeping a close eye on it. We would like a table at or a seat at the table, especially if they're discussing poultry imports, and we want to have a seat there and certainly be involved in any decisions our government might make around that. But this quota should have been removed already, and it hasn't. So that's a bit concerning for us as a poultry industry, Jimmy.
Gary, I want to take a look at some of the other factors affecting the business. I mean, as you and I speak on a regular basis, we know that the poultry industry can be affected almost overnight. And to add to this, there is that market inquiry by the Competition Commission into the poultry sector. And I know we're still very much in early stages here, and there's no doubt Astral and the other poultry producers will comply. Can I get your thoughts on just where we stand at the moment? We've touched on this in previous conversations around how difficult it is to operate in the poultry space. Your thoughts on the Competition Commission wanting to look into this now?
Jimmy, yeah, we have spoken about this before, and I think that what's changed is the Competition Commission have now published the final guidelines for the poultry market inquiry. They are wanting to look at any barriers to entry for new entrants into the sector, and it seems to be quite wide in scope, the inquiry. I mean, dealing with poultry genetics that are imported into the country to be used in the integrated poultry value chain, right up until the end, the retail and wholesale sector. So very wide in its scope, and will take some time to conclude. We're still awaiting the Competition Commission to publish, the timetable of their engagement with industry and with various producers. I think it's important to remind the listeners that this isn't any inquiry into any sort of anti-competitive conduct at all. It's a general market inquiry, as I say, looking at barriers to entry and the integrated nature of the poultry sector. What we can say is we'll engage the process positively. I mean, I think the industry has a good news story to tell, particularly after all the investment and jobs we created and the expansion of localized poultry production on the back of the master plan signed in 2019, with the Department of Trade and Industry and other stakeholders. And certainly, we believe that, scale, economies of scale are very important to us in this business. We essentially produce a commoditized type product where the cost of production is critical to the success of participation in the industry. And for that, an integrated business model is used. And this is not unlike any other poultry sector around the world. I think, you'll see an integrated nature of the business around the world. And the South African poultry industry is not unique in that respect. Anyway, we will engage with the process, and we soon will see whether what angle's taken, but we want to engage positively. We believe we have a good news story, and we're important for local food security and job security. So, we don't want to see any unintended consequences of this inquiry that may negatively impact the business. But there's a long way to before we can even start to concern ourselves with that. Let's go through the questioning first.
Gary, speaking of the good news story, let's end our conversation with a look back at what the stronger financial performance has allowed the business to do. We finally returned an interim dividend this year. We weren't able to have one last year. We had a bumper increase in the final dividend, and the overall total dividend that's being paid to shareholders is north of the 10 rand mark. Significant way to announce to shareholders that if we can, we will continue to reward our shareholders for having their confidence in us. How do you see the new year shaping up? How is the strategy from a business perspective, understanding that you can really only control the controllables?
Absolutely, Jimmy. I mean, 2023 and the national load shedding and bird flu, that's well known, the massive impact it had on us financially. So that we then embarked on a journey to turn around the performance of the company. We had to get rid of the debt burden that we carried out of 2023. Managed to largely do that through 2024, and then 2025 was a time that we set our sights on rebuilding the balance sheet, getting that financial resilience and health back to the balance sheet so that we're able to navigate our way through any, downturn in the sector that we may encounter along the way. I mean, I think you're very familiar with the volatility in earnings in the sector, but certainly we're well positioned as Astral now to look at further growth opportunities and various other strategic initiatives which will allow us to exploit other cost enhancement projects or efficiency projects that are certainly there, and constrained by cash any longer. We've rebuilt the bank balance and we're able to return value to shareholders. We resumed dividend payments at the end of 2024 after that torrid time in 2023, declared an interim dividend, as you rightly said, and paid a dividend in line with our 2x cover, that the board has exercised. And certainly we believe that, we were very happy to declare the final dividend we did and report to the market that this turnaround journey, we believe, is now complete and places us in a strong financial position.
A strong financial position and a good way forward. That is the direction that Astral Foods aims to take going into the new financial year. And we'll keep an eye on how this shapes up. All the best to you and the team, Gary. Thank you so much for joining us to catch up on the year that was. Gary Arnold, Chief Executive Officer at Astral Foods, reflecting on the 2025 financial year.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Last week at the midterm budget policy statement tabled by the Minister of National Treasury, there was an announcement that we would be looking at introducing an infrastructure bond to help finance some of our infrastructure projects. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Economist at Rand Merchant Bank, Isaiah Mhlanga, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Mr. Mhlanga, always lovely having you on the show. Thank you so much for the time, good sir. Initial thoughts around the medium-term budget policy statement and the announcement of this infrastructure bond?
Look, it was a good midterm budget policy statement. The big one is the concurrence with the Reserve Bank as far as the 3% inflation target. It removes much of the uncertainty that still lied in financial markets or investor community. And you saw the bond markets respond quite, you know, drastically, a drop of 20 basis points, in the 10-year bond yield immediately after that announcement. That says markets were expecting, markets were happy, which reduces the debt servicing cost of the state. If you look overall, growth is still quite weak. That's the negative out of the budget. Even in our investor roadshows, that the one aspect that has been raised is a negative. Other than that, debt to GDP ratio still consolidate, even if it's a touch higher than what it was before. In the May budget, that's because nominal growth is lower because of the lower inflation target. So it's rising for the right reasons. If you look at the fiscal deficit, continues to moderate over the medium term, closer to 3% of GDP. That is also good. And what we, you know, quite happy about is the focus on the quality of spending, which shifts away from consumption into infrastructure investments, which should underpin economic growth going forward, which is where the infrastructure bond falls into. A minimum of 15 billion that is going to be raised through this infrastructure bond. It's a positive development that we think is going to help growth going forward.
Isaiah, how would this bond work in principle? I mean, I know that some of the details might still be in the process of being fleshed out. They might not have been finalized and concluded. But in an ideal world, what does an infrastructure bond look like in the economy of South Africa? And how do we make it attractive to investors?
Look, I think the first thing to state is it is a bond. In that respect, it means there is borrowing from capital markets or from investors that's going to take place. By itself, it increases the state's debt. It's similar to what you would do with nominal bonds or inflation-linked bonds in that respect. But what differentiates it is the infrastructure part, where it's forecast to a specific need. You know, typically when the state borrows using all other instruments, the borrowings go into a common revenue pool, which the state can allocate to many other uses like paying salaries and wages, paying for services and goods, or part of it might be also going to investments. But the infrastructure bond is quite specific. It ring fences the borrowings to be used in infrastructure investments. So it would not be necessarily part of the common revenue that is used within the government spending overall, which means it's specific. But it also comes with a lower debt service cost because investors can associate their capital with a specific project, which they can evaluate in terms of the viability of that project and what sort of cash flows that can come out of that project and the return on investment that they can make. So it's specific in that nature, helps to ring fence the revenues or the borrowings out of the general revenue pool, which makes it easier to monitor and but also make sure that infrastructure is delivered.
Isaiah, South Africa has been on a clear drive to increase infrastructure and what we're doing from an infrastructure development perspective. Is this the right way to go about financing that, understanding that we've got different types of financing mixes out there? We've got the private sector willing to participate. We've got government that needs to drive a portion of this as well. Is this kind of a good hybrid to introduce to a emerging market and a growing market like South Africa, understanding that it might actually allow us to attract the right kind of investment for it?
Look, I think this is a right structure. It's a positive development. What we've had over the many years is the quality of our spending of tax revenues have been quite poor. Once you put borrowings into the general revenue pool, the use of that revenue can be anything, but is also subject to leakages through corruption that we are hearing out of the Matlanga Commission and many other commissions that came before that. This then introduces a different mechanism that ring fences borrowing for capital project, which is exactly what we need as a as a country. We need more investment in infrastructure. We need less leakages in the system, and this somehow I think is going to help with that. So it is the right structure, but also the general cost of financing for it is also lower relative to general market borrowing that the government usually undertakes.
I suppose then that would also then mean that we're governed by a different terms and different time horizons from an infrastructure perspective. Some infrastructure projects tend to take longer than others. I think we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Zaya Mhlanga, Chief Economist at Rand Merchant Bank, for joining us to take a look at the South African decision to potentially introduce a infrastructure bond that was announced last week at the midterm budget policy statement.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This segment is brought to you by Bonitas, medical aid for South Africa. As we draw closer to the end of 2025 and head into 2026, you might be wanting to make some important life decisions and adjustments to your life. And one of those conversations undoubtedly would be medical aid coverage, as to whether or not you have adequate coverage and what you should be looking at. Thankfully, the team at Bonitas Medical Fund have some insights they'd love to share with us around this. I'm joined on the line by the principal officer at the Bonitas Medical Fund, Lee Kalakoppen, to take a look at what it is that they have noted in the medical aid space. Lee, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with those points around the medical aid industry. There are a lot of medical aid service providers. We'll get into kind of the schemes versus the medical insurance if we have time for that. But take us through just how you're seeing the medical aid landscape at the moment and what it is that you're noting as a service provider.
Afternoon, Jimmy, and thanks again for having me on your show. For me, some of the key trends that we are experiencing, obviously, changes. It's a very dynamic environment. But perhaps just to take a step back, I think it's always important to remind the listeners that, medical schemes belong to the members and they're not for profit. And key for us as a medical scheme is to take note in terms of what the changes are that's taking place to ensure that we remain relevant, but more so that, we take due care and diligence of those members' funds. So with that in mind, and just on the backdrop of medical scheme increases, what we've observed in the industry is that there's still amalgamations taking place. So lesser medical schemes than 10 years before, because they have to amalgamate due to sustainability challenges. And I think it's important that, schemes must be well prepared in terms of complying with, from a regulatory perspective, with amalgamation, because it's important for those schemes to consider their feasibility studies and ensuring that they act in the best interest of members. So to that end, amalgamations are taking place, but members need to consider whether their schemes remain financially sustainable, and perhaps a little bit more about that later on. In terms of economic pressures, it's still quite a pressing issue for members. But interesting enough, what we've observed, especially going into the open period where people choose their medical aid right now with the rising cost, members are more accepting in terms of joining options that is network-based or has got dedicated service providers to save money. So they're more willing to compromise their freedom of choice to better manage their healthcare costs. And also interesting enough, I think we spoke about it last time, is that the industry and, the market is quite small in terms of 9 million South Africans being on medical aid. But we have seen that younger people are more willing now and acceptable of joining medical schemes. And one would argue that that's as a result of the burden of disease. It doesn't discriminate based on age. But these younger members joining medical schemes are more willing to consider options that is more digitally enabled, willing to do virtual consultations and digital healthcare solutions. So in the main, to summarize, amalgamations, member economic pressures, and younger members that's willing to consider digital solutions, Jimmy.
Now, Lee, I come from a financial services background where I often speak about regulation and the importance of regulation. I know very little about medical schemes regulation, but I do know that it is a highly regulated space. Take us through the kinds of regulations that are out there and why they're so important when we're looking at protecting consumers.
Most definitely. We've got we operate in a highly regulated environment. Perhaps before answering your question, we would love to see greater levels of healthcare reform taking place to enable people to have access to medical scheme. To that end, one of the key aspects is health insurance. People opt for a health insurance versus a medical aid, but in actual fact, when comparing the two on paper, they not really similar, and members choose a lower cost in the form of insurance. But to that end, the medical scheme industry in South Africa, as what you've mentioned, is highly protected, and it's regulated by the Council of Medical Schemes to protect members' interests and ensure that we as medical schemes and the Board of Trustees that's assigned with that fiduciary duty to protect members' interests acts fairly in that regard. So to that end, all medical schemes must comply with the Medical Schemes Act, which sets out obviously the laws and the principles associated with it, and ensure that there's good governance, robust governance, that takes place at all times. So the regulator is there to oversee the industry, and some key regulations is things, and to my earlier point around reforms that needs to take place, is, for instance, the demarcation rules that is currently applicable between medical schemes and health insurance, PMB reviews, and more importantly, one of the aspects that we as medical schemes, and particularly Bonitas, have been advocating, is the introduction of the low-cost benefit options. We believe that that will open up the market considerably, allowing specifically younger members to join that is pressured from an affordability perspective to join medical schemes. So in short, those are the aspects that I can summarize for your listeners, Jimmy.
Lee, speaking of the considerations from a member perspective, especially the financial ones, what else should members be looking at when choosing a scheme? I know that a lot of the decisions are centered around finances, but it is important to ensure that you've got adequate coverage as well. What are some of these considerations that members should be thinking about?
Jimmy, to my earlier point when I touched on some of the trends like amalgamations taking place, asking the question why amalgamations are taking place between medical schemes, and at the center of those, or the rationale for it, is really the financial sustainability of the scheme. Because key for it is to consider a scheme's ability to pay claims. So some of the key sustainability factors that consumers must consider when choosing a medical scheme is their claims paying ability. Their credit rating is normally a very good indicator in terms of how well the scheme is governed and managed from a sustainability level, the solvency levels, as well as the reserves, to see that the scheme meets those regulatory obligations that our CMS, our Council for Medical Schemes, is setting on behalf of members to ensure that they're actually part of a well-managed, well-governed, and sustainable scheme. Over the years, yes, we have seen some schemes coming under financial pressures, which requires the regulator to intervene. And for that reason, why the financial aspect is key. But Jimmy, some basic aspects that consumers must consider is schemes growing. Are they attracting young new members to the scheme? So membership growth, attracting and retaining members, is key in terms of ensuring that members join it. And then finally, obviously from a consumer perspective, is the benefits that a scheme offer rich enough to cover their current healthcare needs, wherever they are in terms of their life stages? And what unique offerings do they provide to ensure that there's better support for their health and personal needs? So in summary, financial sustainability of the scheme, growth of the scheme, at the center of it, does that scheme and the options that it provide cater for your healthcare needs at a particular time in your life? And that of your family, of course.
Some very important considerations when determining what medical aid scheme is best suited for your needs. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Principal Officer of Bonitas Medical Fund, Lee Keller-Koppen, for joining us to take a look at choosing the right medical aid. This segment was brought to you by Bonitas, medical aid for South Africa.
Ask yourself, what matters most?
I just want to be there when she takes her first steps.
And still be around for her first dance.
It's knowing I'm not just covered, I'm cared for.
It's having the strength to say I'm back.
It's just knowing Mom will be okay.
It's coming home.
Bonitas goes beyond benefits and claims. Bonitas, medical aid for South Africa. Voted number one medical aid in the Ask Africa Orange Index Awards for the second year running. Visit bonitas.co.za and find your plan.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Digital Drive Time on a Monday. We get to explore some latest developments in the digital landscape with our resident tech and EV specialist and founder of recharged.co.za, Nafisa Akabor. She joins me on the line now to take a look at Black Friday scams this time around. Nafisa, lovely to have you on the show. As always, thanks so much for taking the time. With Black Friday pretty much 2 weeks away at the end of November, I've seen a couple of companies start with some Black Friday promotions, some of them doing month-long promotions. But we also know that this is a time where people can get easily scammed because you expect to see the deals, and sometimes it's difficult to tell whether they're too good to be true or not. How do people navigate Black Friday?
Hey, Jimmy. Great to be back as always. Yeah, so I actually thought of discussing this topic for today, and Black Friday is literally end of next week, because I was browsing TikTok on the weekend and I saw a fake Superb List ad and I was very surprised. Well, it said 80% off. So before I even clicked the link, I went into my Superb List app and I actually saw there was no 80% sale. So I went back onto TikTok and I clicked it because I knew that kind of scam wasn't a clicking scam. It was more to get you to shop on the site and maybe get your details or never send you the product. And I want to let people who are listening, like, if you come across something like that, and 80% of course is too good to be true, so you know that's immediately the first red flag. But the second thing I paid attention to was the URL itself. It read like superblist-discountsale.com, which we all know is not the Superblist website, so that incorrect URL is one of a very key thing to look out for. And then also the badly worded about pages, there were things missing, just full stops and spaces randomly put there. And then I saw a whole bunch of logos at the bottom of the website. So obviously I clicked on the Apple logo first. And what do you know, there was 85% off an iPhone 16 Pro, which is insane. Like, you're paying less than 3,000 Rand for it. So those alone were all the red flags, like a massive sale, wrong URL, and then a big ticket item for so much less. So yeah, I was surprised about it. I reported the ad. I'm not sure when they're going to remove it, but hopefully they do. But yeah, in light of that, I thought it would be great to discuss some tips and how you can avoid falling for them or Black November, Black Friday. So I think the first one is to stick to a reputable retailer who's been around for years. You just need to be cautious. If it's a store you've never heard of or you found their social media and they never had posts before November, then I think that's immediately a red flag. And then always check the URL, as I mentioned, with the Superblist fake site. Even an HTTPS alone is not good enough. You have to look at the URL. Like, you know, I mean, anyone can now get that HTTPS, but you have to see if it's the official website. And if somehow you get an SMS or an email about a sale, don't click the link. Rather, go to the website you think it is and type it up yourself so you can avoid going to a fake site. And then, I mean, I very briefly touched on it. Just be aware of deals that are too good to be true. Like, I mean, you're not going to get a PlayStation 5 for less than 5,000 Rand or an iPhone Pro for under 3,000 or maybe a Dyson Airwrap for about 2,500. Those big ticket items are never going to be 80% off in any sale. So I think just stay away from those. And another very crucial thing, I think, is not to pay an individual via EFT. Now, I know there's a lot of social media businesses who do this, but you have to be wary about that because it's better to stick to a secure checkout method, which lets you pay with a credit card, because we know that banks offer insurance on credit card transactions. And later on, if you never receive the product, you can always file for a dispute and get your money back. And you can't do that with EFT. And then also don't fall for those WhatsApp voucher rewards and forwards where they say, fill in the survey, you're getting something. I mean, those, they also want to steal your personal information. And I think mainly for Black Friday or Black November, compare prices on multiple platforms just to get an idea what an item would cost that you want to buy, like that you need rather. And then also look at the reduced prices to see, you know, if it's a good enough deal, whatever percentage, but 80% would be a red flag. And then also make a list of what you need and stick to that before just falling for a random cheap deal that you never wanted anyway. And then another main thing is to look for proper contact information. Just say you came by a news store and maybe they are legit, then just go to their website and check whether they have a landline number or like a physical address, company registration. And I think also key is like a return policy, then you know they're kind of legit. And if they have like only a Gmail address, I would avoid it completely. And I think the last key tip I want to share is to use a virtual card for shopping online because of the tokenization method it uses where it randomly generates a number. And in case that card information gets compromised, you can always delete it and you don't have, and then you avoid the admin of actually replacing a physical card. So those are my main tips for Black Friday.
Nafisa, you mentioned that some of the other sites or some of the deals that are available are easy red flags to pick up on. We have seen the rise of online service providers and e-commerce stores, particularly the likes of Amazon launching in South Africa, Temu launching in South Africa. I believe Alibaba is an AliExpress or next in line to do that. How then do we navigate these new platforms, understanding that we might not understand everything about these platforms, and how do we know if the deals on these platforms are legit or not?
So interestingly, yeah, I actually made my first purchase from Temu just this weekend. Well, it got delivered this weekend. It was a DJI item. And I've never really looked into buying them because I found the ads very invasive, but I finally caved. This item was not available anywhere else and it was like sold out around the world. I went and looked at the listing. I could see the actual DJI wording, the images they used, and they pulled it. So I knew from that reason that they were selling a legit product. And sometimes the web, the marketplaces like Temu, they will say verified seller or the shopper or storefront. And if you go on AliExpress, it will tell you that the item itself is a verified item. So they are also giving you that little badge so you can confirm it's an authentic item. And also when we go to Shein, and maybe if you're going to talk more on the luxury goods side, for example, Coach and Armani Beauty as examples, they actually have verified storefronts on Shein. So I think it's important to look for verified stores and sellers. And if just say you want an item and it's a generic and they don't mention the brand name and you know that's the product you want from a brand, then avoid it because they're not mentioning the brand name. So in my case, I saw it was a DJI item. Everything looked legit. And also importantly, I looked at the seller's ratings and he had a 4.5+ star rating. So that was good enough for me. And that's why I made the purchase and it was obviously not fake. So I think, yeah, just look for verifications and from the websites themselves. I think the Chinese guys are trying extra hard because people have the wrong impression of what they're about. They are a marketplace like Amazon and Takealot, and there are third-party sellers. And you could very well be tricked into buying a fake product, but I think you just need to do a little bit more research and look at the page, look at the reviews, and that kind of thing.
Do your homework, folks. It's the only way you're going to stay safe during this Black Friday or this Black November, depending on where you're buying your goods from. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you, as always, to Nafisa for the time and for the insights. Founder of Recharged.co.za, Nafisa Akabor, joining us to take a look at how to navigate Black Friday in the online world.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And that's the show for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, of course, they will be made available as podcasts for you to catch up on. We will be keeping an eye on the developments unfolding this week and bringing you all the latest, including that budget speech, or rather the MPC decision on the rates that we are expecting on Wednesday. For now, it's coming up to 7 o'clock. Kulafela Tofo and the SAFM News team are standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. So from my side, good night.